Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The main team.
Mega Bears fan.
Welcome to Polycast, episode 435, So It Shall Be. My name is New Earth Relic, and I'm joined by regular hosts, the main team.
777777.
Makalua?
What do you mean, 2025?
And Canis Albinus.
Study the past if you would define the future.
Okay, so what do we actually know?
Not that much yet, right?
Who knows, but we're going to find out.
Yeah, because in case you slept through yesterday, Civ 7 got announced at the Summer Games Fest. And the trailer was pretty cool. I did like that. But there's not much else. There's like, we don't have gameplay footage until what? Late July? Or did it just say summer?
They said August.
Oh, did they? Ugh.
Yeah, it'll be August.
Okay, and there was a little bit of Sid himself speaking at the end, which I've slept since then, so my brain's blanked out what he talked about. But it was nice to see him. It's been a while.
Yeah,
he was doing the Mr. Rogers thing and trying to be nice and thanking the team and the fans and all that.
But also, we have to wait till 2025, boo!
We have a topic later in the show that will go into a little bit more detail about how long we probably have to wait. But we will cover that when we get to it. So let's look at what we actually saw in the teaser trailer.
Sand. I saw sand.
There was a lot of sand.
A lot of things popping up out of the sand and becoming other things and going through history, basically, with different voiceovers, which is probably the various leaders.
It's possible that that's what it was. They might also just be there for effect. There were a few recognizable people in the trailer. I think we could see Cleopatra, probably Genghis Khan, neither of which are big surprises, considering.
Well, been there just about since the beginning.
Mongols are not consistently in the Civ games on release, though. So it'd be nice to see them.
That is true.
Technically not Cleopatra, but Egypt has been in since the beginning.
Egypt is kind of a staple. It kind of has to be there because of the pyramids.
Yeah, we did see those being confirmed, at least in the trailer.
Also,
absolutely no surprise.
We saw that railroads and ships are there. They're definitely in the cinematic, at least. There were at least some knights. We saw the Apollo program, so that's pretty much confirmed to be in the game.
I wonder if the space elevator will be worth it.
It wasn't even in the last game.
I know, I haven't been able to argue over that in ages.
Was it even in Civ 5?
I don't remember.
I don't think it was.
Yeah, Civ 5, you fired off the rocket and you won.
Well, that's how it was in Civ 2 as well, or Civ 4 as well.
Yeah, if you're playing properly, you shouldn't build the space elevator normally. It slows down your space, Jerry.
Too expensive.
There's some like really odd edge cases where you might play it, but it's like a tiny fraction of games where you would win space.
So here's some of the information we have from the actual release page. It apparently is launching on PS4, PS5, Xbox One, Series X and Series S, and the Switch, and Steam all at the same time.
Well, we're in that era.
Yeah.
Seems like most games
also
are
poor
doing
Mac
that.
Users.
Yeah, get wrecked. Buy a real computer, lol.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
Just because
you're on believe that.
Like, Steam does work on the Mac, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a question of compatibility. Like, yeah. Steam even works on Linux. It just does the game work.
Yeah, I was actually reading the numbers on the OSs, and Linux actually beats out Mac for users on Steam.
Wow.
That's not surprising, considering the price point.
Also, Steam Deck.
Yeah, it's mostly Steam Deck. They finally reached 2% market share on Steam, the majority of which is Steam's proprietary OS for Steam Deck. So we've got all of that stuff happening. It appears, based on the Steam page for Civ 7, which does exist, go wishlist it, that it has full controller support.
I mean, when they're doing it on PS and Xbox and all of those, you kind of need to.
Yeah, it'd be odd to sell the game and then be like, oh, mouse and keyboard only, better buy your plugins.
For reference,
I just hope that that doesn't mean that the controls are going to be crappy.
For reference, in Civ 6, that is not mentioned at all. So, I know playing on the Switch with Civ 6 that there were some issues with controlling, but it was mostly due to the fact that the Switch is kind of slow when you're playing such a heavy game.
I mean, if you bind your buttons correctly and you have like a decent sensitivity on your analogs, like you'd be slower, but I could see doing it on a console. I just, like, I don't want them to ignore hotkeys or not have useful menu features, etc. But as a consequence of doing it, but there's no reason that has to be the case. Like, you can absolutely make controller key binds and then still make a good UI. So I hope that they do that. I'm not going to hold my breath because Civ 6 was better than 5, but none of them have been very good. But hopefully.
The Steam page also says third-party account required for 2K.
Don't love that.
Yeah, I know. And it's like all games lately, but it's still annoying.
I mean, they've been pushing it really hard in Civ 6 to get Julius Caesar and the Scout Cat, but it just means it's going to be harder to get rid of the stupid launcher.
Yeah, and that thing's the worst. Every time I go to start up Turncast, it's just like, oh, I'm joining the game. Oh, I gotta wait for the launcher. Oh, launcher needs to update. Hold on.
Yeah.
Gonna fix some of the outstanding bugs in Civ 6? Nope, just gonna patch the launcher, because...
like, they already had a launcher.
It's Steam. Called Steam, and it still works. It works better than any other launcher.
That's because it's been used as a good launcher for ages.
Yeah. Are they past 20 years? Yeah, they're past 20 years.
Yeah, and the most impressive part about Steam is that even though they've been around forever, not only are they keep improving the product, but there's a lot of competitors that are moving in, and they just aren't even close to being as good.
Yeah.
And, like, not even the edge cases, but some of the basic stuff.
Yeah, I don't even think about it too often because I just take that for granted. But, yeah, they'll probably be remembered as one of the more impressive gaming success stories generally.
I mean, Valve doesn't have to put out a lot of games anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, it found its niche, really.
Well, I suppose Dota 2 gives them a lot of money.
Yeah, I think Valve would raise an eyebrow at saying League for them.
Well, you know how it is.
But there, too, like, the games they have released have been pretty solid, so, you know, it's hard to...
I've heard that Half-Life Alyx was good.
I do not know their full library. I just know that they do have good games, and that already puts them ahead of a good chunk of competition in recent memory.
Yeah, whenever I've tried other downloadable service things, I just get annoyed of, why can't I do this on Steam? It's not just that I'm used to it, it works better.
Yeah.
Very rarely do I have problems with Steam.
Yeah, I have to use Epic's stuff for Fortnite when friends play that, and Ubi's for X Defiant, which just came out recently. They're so much worse as launchers.
There's a reason
the games
why...
are reasonable, but the launcher just, like, it makes it worse rather than better.
It's called the you don't play dance, where you try to join a multiplayer lobby in Uplay, and somebody can't see somebody else, so they're like, okay, everybody stop and restart their service, and if that doesn't work, it's like, okay, somebody else try to be the host, and if that doesn't work, it's like, oh, can somebody or anybody see one person who's online and invite them that way? And there's just a whole long list of permutations you have to try and get everybody into a game sometimes.
You don't play indeed. You know you have it bad when you're making, like, getting a Paradox lobby going look relatively better.
Paradox lobbies. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say,
Uh-oh. Did we lose Mackie?
Welcome to Technical Difficulties, the podcast.
All right.
I was saying that hopefully the Civ 7 multiplayer is going to be through Steam, because while it can be a pain occasionally, it's still a heck of a lot better. And do we, you know, because I'm playing multiplayer every weekend and sometimes during the week, and problems almost never. It's just some of the sync issues that's still in there occasionally, but it's very stable in that sense.
5 on release was awful. 6 has been pretty good after its initial.
out of Civ got to be reasonable too. Oh my gosh.
Well, yeah, I would say that Civ has not been a pillar of multiplayer, but they've also not been the worst, because there have been some pretty lull or bad.
It has definitely improved.
Yeah. And Paradox, like, I mean, I guess like when you're just playing with a couple people, it works pretty well, that multiplayer. You like try to organize large, that can be a little iffy.
I mean, Paradox also does a lot of real-time games, and that's a lot more difficult to pull off than, let's say, Civilization with the turn-based.
In terms of sync, yes, but I'm also just talking about the part of getting everyone into the lobby and starting the game and having the game start decently.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. I think in that regard, they can be compared directly to Civ, and they do not compare favorably at large numbers.
Yeah, that part is not good.
Then again,
that said, yes, it is hard to sync real-time, although many games manage it. And pretty well.
We were talking about Civ 7.
Well, that's why I brought it up, the multiplayer.
Yeah, we hope it has good multiplayer, but we don't know anything about the mechanics or any of the way that anything works yet. So we just have to hope and pray.
I mean, the only thing we know so far is that 64-bit only.
That's not surprising.
I'm pretty sure Civ 6 is also 64-bit only.
Even like EU4 got moved to 64-bit only, or maybe it was Hearts of Iron, one of the two that released like a while back, switched it to only supporting. That's going to be like every high-spec game or modest-spec game going forward, I'm sure.
To be fair, I don't think it's reasonable to make a 32X or an 86X game today if you're not planning on being backwards. Unless you're making like legacy code, because I don't think any of the processors that have been released in the last 10 years have been 86X only.
Yeah, about to say it's longer than that. The first ones came out 20 years ago ish.
Yeah, but I remember there was a lot of struggle to get people to move to it, and at least Civ 5, when it came out, did support 86X.
Yeah, yeah, but now it's pretty much 64 or bust, and that's, I think, fine to state.
It would be hard to find a new computer that didn't have that, unless you're talking about something that's a different architecture, like ARM or something like that, but that's a whole
something
other thing.
Something you wouldn't get to play games on, yeah.
You probably wouldn't want to play games on it like that.
Well, at least since it's not until 2025. We all have time, and anybody out there in the audience has time to save up for the inevitable new computer that you're going to need to play Civ 7, so your current one does not blow up.
Well, if you need 64 to play Civ 6, then you probably have that at least. It's going to be the other specs that may or may not be a bottleneck.
Yeah, about to say, if you're trying to run on a 32-bit processor, I mean, that thing's got to be 20 years old. Like, it's not going to be doing anything for you anyways.
Yeah, turn times are going to be a little long, and not just for me, but for you personally, if you try to run a game like that on that kind of stuff.
Now that I think about it, if your computer has more than 3.5 gigs of RAM, it's definitely running 64-bit anyway, so
yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. It's impossible to find a computer with less than 8 gigs shipping now, I think, unless you go for like the budgiest bargain bin.
Yeah,
even then you can get more than that for like less than 500 easily.
Yeah.
At least last I checked. Your bottleneck is on cost, like graphics card and CPU.
Yeah, CPUs. I mean, I was looking up at $400 laptops for a friend recently, and even though those had 64-bit processors, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're going to bottleneck on something other than being 64-bit for Civ 7 in terms of specs.
Yeah, probably when they give us the gameplay stuff, they'll also give us a better idea maybe about the specs required, you know, minimum and high end.
Yeah, the thing I'm most interested in is if they'll manage to go and take a lot of advantage with the new 3D V-cache parts that AMD's putting out, just because they have a huge cache, and that's very good for AI performance because it's usually a lot of repeated calculations. So in the games that really use it, you see huge uplifts.
Oh, that'd be fantastic for me personally. I hate the long
time. Oh, go ahead.
I'm done. I said what I needed. All you.
Civ has never really been graphics bound, though. It's mostly been CPU bound because of all the calculations in between turns.
Well, yeah, that's why I said the X3D CPUs. Just because if you can go and have repeated calculations and keep that stuff cached instead of shipping out to memory, that's a lot of space that the electricity has to move, so you end up getting huge uplifts in turn times.
Yeah, if you could throw like that, even just the pathfinding up into the cache or something. Maybe they can also not get blocked in weird places.
Well, that's going to go into its logic, not its performance. Yeah, I would be surprised if we have a high quality of play from the AI. I don't think we can realistically expect that.
Considering how strategy. The AI works, probably not.
Yeah.
About to say, haven't you guys heard? AI is a new buzzword.
I know.
Well, AI, I mean, you could, in principle, train an unwinnable AI. If you had enough performance to like do that kind of neural net training and make it a really strong thing, and you could redo that every patch that changed the rules, you could make an unwinnable AI if you wanted. But
yeah, but that's always been their balance.
Like we said in the past, that's both costly and not what players actually want to experience.
Yeah, the players want a challenge up to a certain thing. They don't want to have an unwinnable, unbeatable AI, because then people don't want to play the game, and they want us to play the game.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure like some small fraction of the player base would enjoy playing against it here and there, kind of like some people will play against Stockfish and Chess. Like, you don't have a realistic expectation of winning, but yeah, these people still use it. But yeah, I don't think that's financially worth it for any game company, unless something happens between now and the near future where it becomes super cheap to do this out of nowhere.
Honestly, one of the things I'm thinking about for the AI is how much of a difficulty curve Civilization has at the highest levels. For example, like building Monument first will usually lose you the game, but it's going to be forever until you realize you've lost. And there's such a low correlation between Monument first versus winning that it's really tough to pick out that as a misplay, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that will lose you the game in the current series because they're relatively forgiving. But it is like you can still take it as an objective misplay just in terms of your Civilization growth curve. But I'm pretty sure you could do that in Soul and Deity. It would just be harder. That's a good question. And a lot of that will come down to the mechanics themselves. Because like Civ 5 and 6 are easier on Deity, in part just because of it's a question of both the bonuses are a little bit less than they were in like Civ 4. And also the AI just cannot put as many units in the same place as it could in Civ 4. And mechanically, the ability to put that many units in the same place was extremely hard to deal with before Nukes. Because you had siege to do collateral initiative, but that would damage like five or six things, and for sane amounts of production that was a huge fraction of a stack. So like siege, like cannons or catapults or whatever, was really dangerous to stacks. But the Deity AI would like throw 150 units on there, and so like doing collateral to 5 units at a time, you'd have to hit that with so many siege units before you'd start getting stuff where the AI had damaged units defending. Like, that was a real problem to deal with. That could cause major grief. And that just wasn't a thing in Civ 5 or 6 due to one unit per tile or, you know, the mix of, you know, you have a couple unit layers. But even in Civ 6, you can only stuff so many units into a given front. So, the player can engineer terrain modifiers and general bonuses and, like, chokes. And all of a sudden, the AI can't actually kill anything, even though it has enormous production advantages. And I think Civ 6 just has less production advantage in addition to that on compared to like, so that stuff will make it harder or easier at the high levels. But regardless, you're playing a different game when you're playing at high level on single player versus like playing against other people. But yeah, I'm curious what they'll do.
Do we have anything else that we can say definitively about Civ 7?
There's not that much information.
There's
yet,
very little information, unfortunately.
I mean, if you want, I can talk about how it's the same font as Civ 6 for the logo.
I did notice that because I had to create the splash screen for this episode of the podcast, and I didn't have to change the font, so yippee.
Color scheme's a little bit different.
Yeah, there's a lot more blue.
I like it, though.
I do, too.
Yeah, it looks fine.
The aesthetic is it looks like it's embossed leather as opposed to whatever it was before.
Yellow?
Leather.
No, I think I was making a joke about how Civ 6 had a very yellow theme.
Yeah, sunset, I guess.
Yeah, I think the 6/7 font looks good. So, and if they want to make that like a defining feature of the series going forward, I'm not going to have anything negative to say about it, whatever. Because you do want some brand recognition, and that will help.
Honestly, quality font that's legible, I will take it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a high standard, but sometimes not everyone clears it.
Oh, there's one other thing about Civ 7 we can say definitively. It has hexes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the logo is a hex. And it's like, well, everybody was wanting squares back. Are going to be disappointed.
I think they're both fine. And I don't have a problem with hexes. And now, forget they release squares. I wouldn't cry tears either. It'd be fine either way.
What we need?
There's trade-offs between them.
We just need smaller tiles, or rather more, yeah. More tiles.
Yeah, if we get more hexes, that would be nice. The fact that they're hexes is less meaningful to me than that we have more of them between cities. If we're going to do the one unit per tile thing again, which we don't know for sure. We're probably going to get something like Civ 6 where like you have layers of units and you like probably put more than one thing in one tile because it's a little less frustrating than having literally only one unit per tile. But I would be surprised if we saw a return of true stacking.
I think those days are gone.
Yeah. Well, there's some benefit from a mechanic design perspective to limit frontage. You also see that in really all the Paradox games I've played to a degree. Like, there's a limit how many things you can put in one place that can fight at the same time, because that's just a useful constraint to allow the developers to make quality matter over quantity. Like, if you literally uncap it, then you just put whatever you want there and you just keep spamming until you've enough. And if that doesn't solve the problem, you can spam more. If you limit frontage, then you actually have to think about what you're doing with that frontage. So there is some benefit to that. And that was true even in Civ 4. I think Civ 4 is the best experience that out of the Civs I've played personally. Not everyone agrees with me there. But that, like I said on the deity example, at extreme levels, that did become a problem. Because the whole point of Siege was to splash damage and disincentivize really big stacking. And at normal production constraints, that was true. But at the ridiculous stack sizes, it stopped mattering. And then you really did need nukes or something to deal with it. And yeah, I think it's just easier to balance and create reasonable trade-offs approaches if you have some kind of frontage cap. I don't think you need one unit per tile. I don't even know if like 10 units per tile is too much, but you need something to make it reasonable.
I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I remember Stellaris, for instance. For the longest time, the dominant strategy was spam the corvettes, and you just show up against an army with, you know, a billion corvettes, and you just have too many missiles per second.
Yeah.
It also just made frame time crawl because of the fact that it's trying to calculate, you know, a billion corvettes shooting missiles.
Well, making your frames crawl is the Stellaris special, from my understanding. I technically own the game. I've never played it, but for my friends that do, like, once you get into late game, it seems like there's a lot of ways that game can crawl.
Go away, get a cup of coffee kind of crawl.
Yeah. Well, that's not so great. It's already not great in turn-based when you're spending a decent percentage of the time not playing, but frame rate crawling when you're in a real-time game, that's a special sauce.
Because then you get to misclick and totally miss what you're trying to target, and then they just go flying past the enemy fleet and get murdered.
Yeah, the way they handle pops in that game is a little dubious from my understanding when it comes to performance.
I'm just remembering how it used to be in EU4. You'd get the Ottomans with 500,000 troops and then the entire HRE with about as many, and they're all fighting each other in the end game, and it's just like, oh, it's taking seconds for each day to go by.
Yeah, well, I think that's why they moved it to 64 bit, because it wasn't that first.
It definitely needed it.
Because now, like, you actually have larger troop stuff now, but the game's performance improved enough. Man, that's such a bizarre life cycle for EU4 in terms of how things change. Actually, I had a spat with the same developer who took over a different studio, still of Paradox, and they came back and like made the game way better. And now, like, I've like lost all my sense of beef with that dev just because, man, they really, really turned that game around. Not just a little bit. I'm impressed. But yeah, early EU4 had some really fun meme stuff you could do, especially when like they didn't have caps on stuff. You could get attrition to 0%. You could get maintenance to 0 or negative. So like making larger armies gave you money. There's a lot of like broken animals like that were funny. And the 500 stacks with no attrition that was a balance issue for sure.
Yeah.
Because they, like, if you fight 10 to 1 in that game back then, Now there's the rules of that changed, but back then, if you anytime you fought 10-1, you would get an instantaneous stack wipe without resolving the battle. So the nation with like 10 times the troops would just keep winning fights against pretty significant armies with no casualties whatsoever and no attrition, because apparently if you reduce your consumption to zero, your men don't need to eat anymore or drink water or anything, and they have infinite bullets and just walk around deleting everything just by touching it. And you could assault provinces, like the forts and provinces, without a breach back then, too. And that also applied the 10-1 rule for the garrison. So all those horrible penalties you took on storming a fort were out the window, because you would resolve the combat instantaneously, so you just take the province and move on. Yeah, that was special.
There's going to be something that's broken to that level when Civ 7 launches. Somebody will find it in the first couple of weeks that they'll have to patch it.
Yeah, probably. I mean, 6 had some busted stuff, but I don't think it had anything quite that busted, or like as busted as negative maintenance was.
Yeah. That's busted.
Oh my god.
Game.
Negative maintenance in EU4, or like the more you go over force limit, it had a non-linear effect on your on maintenance for armies. So like you would exponentially increase your maintenance as you went over force limit. But if you're exponentially increasing negative maintenance, then you're just making more and more money. The only thing you need to be careful about is to not make so much money that it Stack Overflow and bankrupted you.
Another bonus to 64-bit. It takes a lot longer to hit Stack Overflow.
Yeah. Yeah, nowadays you just hit 1 million ducts and cap that. It's pretty hard to Stack Overflow it.
If you'd like to Stack Overflow your Civ collection, most of the Civ stuff is on sale.
Yes.
All the versions 6, 5 complete, and 3 complete, but not 4. It's not Civ 4 for some reason. I don't understand.
And none of the Civ 4 DLCs are even in that page.
That's bizarre, because Civ 4 is on Steam. What? Like, why wouldn't they want to sell it?
I don't know. It's strange.
Yeah, because there's a Civ complete edition, but it's still like $30. It's like, but okay, sell us everything except 4. All right.
Well, I mean, they're selling base Civ 6 for $3, so.
Yes.
And the Anthology Edition for $25, which is even lower than when it was at its 30, in its year of 30 last year, when they had it on sale for pretty much the whole year at $30 for the entire anthology. So let's talk about how Civ 7 was released and potential windows for release times.
Was really?
Well, it was announced, it was soft announced a few months ago when they said, yes, we're working on the next iteration of Civ. No, it's not a mobile game. And then yesterday morning at like 7 in the morning, they accidentally leaked the front page of 2k.com with the Civ 7 logo.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it was gone pretty quick, but not before somebody noticed and took pictures of it.
Such as the internet, yeah. I wonder how many seconds you could release something before someone would capture it on the internet. Probably not many.
I think it all depends on how earnestly people are looking for something or how big your site is. I don't know I don't know how many hits the 2K website gets every day, but I assume it gets some.
Yeah, considering there was a little bit, I think, of a suspicion that it could get announced, I think people were probably checking it a little more frequently also.
We knew they were going to announce something because their logo was on the We're Participating in the Summer Games Fest list. And also, we have a thread, which was our other topic, that is kind of feeding into this one, where they were talking about the Take-Two Games Fiscal Year 2025 Quarterly Report. Which implied that there would be at least one other major game released during fiscal 2025, and there was an argument about whether it was going to be like Mafia or Borderlands or Civ 7. And that thread, we didn't take it last episode because it was still very fresh. And then, they announced it the day before we're recording, so we kind of missed the boat on that one entirely. But part of this tells me that when we say 2025 for Civ 7's release, I suspect it's going to be January, February, March, somewhere in that time frame.
Yeah, if they're already going to be showing this gameplay in August, that means they would have something relatively well put together already. If they're ready to show it by August, they're probably going through their last some polishes and stuff before they put out a first public version.
Well, there's two things that lead me to that conclusion, most obviously. And that's that they said it's coming out on Switch. And next year, or even later this year, they're expecting the Switch 2 to be announced and released. So if it was going to be a game that was supposed to be on Switch 2, you would have expected it to be later in the year. But they said Switch, so presumably that means it'll be on Switch when it still matters.
I mean, they've done releases for consoles after the new one comes out. The Metroid one that came out on the 3DS after the Switch came out?
Yes.
But yeah.
Yes, that is true. But what I'm saying is, if it was going to be on the Switch 2 rather than the Switch... Well, I guess Switch 2 hasn't been officially announced, has it?
They're announcing the announcement of the announcement for an announcement, like, August, I think.
Well, that could be part of it, so maybe that doesn't matter, but...
Especially on the console side, I think you also want to have a lot more time to go and play around with the hardware, just to make sure, because usually those are very custom pieces of hardware.
Yeah.
Whereas computers, I know there's a lot more combinations... But in general, you're like, okay, I have, you know, like an RDNA 3 GPU, and I have, you know, a 7800X3D, let's say. And you're like, okay, we're basically done here. Whereas on the Switch, you're just like, okay, so this is a custom piece of hardware. It's based on, you know, NVIDIA's, I think that would probably be custom version of the 40 series GPU and like a Tegra something.
I'm pretty sure that anybody who is making a major game for Switch probably has at least some idea of what the Switch 2 stuff is going to have on it. Maybe they have dev versions already. Who knows?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, probably. But I'm also not sure how that part of it works, so I don't want to speculate too much.
Usually they come out about a year or a year and a half in advance of release.
Especially for the people they want to have launch titles as well. We'll probably get even sooner than that.
Yeah.
But okay, it's going to be on Switch. We know it's going to be on regular or original Switch. It may also come out for Switch 2 later.
Well, the other thing is Switch 2 is supposed to be completely generation or completely backwards compatible. So that may just make it run on Switch 2 natively anyway.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I would appreciate that a lot. The other thing is fiscal year 2025 ends in June of next year, at the end of June. So even at the latest, since it's projected for 2025, it would come out before June 30th.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about that part, but...
Well, we're looking at the quarterly report from fiscal year 2025.
Yeah. I was going to say it wasn't going to be in the fall because GTA 6 comes out in fall 2025 and they probably don't want to
give
too much cash away. But
Yeah,
and looking at the 6 timeline, they announced it May 2016. They had the trailer E3, what was that, June?
Yep.
Then released it 7 months later. So that's a possibility. Didn't the expansions for Civ 6 also come out in January, February?
I know Gathering Storm did. I don't know about Rise and Fall. I think Rise and Fall might have been fall, actually. Let me check. February 8th, so I am wrong.
Yeah, and that sounds like a missed opportunity there, right?
Well, if they're planning for a February release, that would line up with August, because historically, they have this thing about not announcing too early. So maybe the reason we haven't seen any official... gameplay and such is because it's too early for them to, you know, be willing to show anything, because if they want to keep it to 6 months.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate the not showing it off too early. Feels like a lot of games have the we're going into early access thing going on, and after the early access, like, okay, I got through the first, you know, fifth of the levels, okay, this game's okay, and then, you know, the next bunch of levels comes out in 2 years and just feels like you've played already and you lose a lot of that hype.
Well, that's not the kind of game we're talking about right now, because there's not really levels in Civ. But I fully understand.
Yeah, think about mechanics or something. You're like, okay, we have diplomatic victory coming in 6 months as part of an early access program or whatever. It just seems bad.
I think it works better with some types of games than others.
Right.
Not so much for turn-based.
Unless you're Millennia and take out nukes.
Mm.
So I'm still hoping that they don't put Russia in the base game.
Yeah, I mean, it would be kind of fun to go and see them do a little bit of a shake-up.
Yeah.
I think Russia's been the base every time so far.
Yeah, and they kind of don't deserve it right now, so... Then again, who knows, we might get a first-party, or a first-game Indonesia or something, since they're getting... Since they have such a large population of customers.
Yeah, having a less Eurocentric balance on the initial release would be nice.
Russia's part Asian, right?
Well, if they do like it, they did last time, it's Peter and Imperial Russia. I'm not so mad about that.
Now, it should be one of the Tartarstan rulers of Russia, because that would be fun. Turn Russia into a horde.
Hordes are a good time.
So we have one other topic today, and then we'll move into theory crafting about what we should probably see in Civ 7. And that's, did anybody play the Challenge of the Month, the yep. Reach for the Heavens?
And also got to watch the video of Potato McWhiskey himself playing it.
Yeah?
It was interesting the way he was developing that first city, because he basically, for a while... A lot of turns was basically one city challenge. He was just pumping the capital really hard full of faith and things. And he did a lot better than I knew how to leveraging Khmer's special traits, you know, because they get a lot more, they get the extra food with the holy sites. You know, I could have grown cities a lot faster with that. And I mean, just the level of planning out he did for the capital was great. It was like, you know, in a single player game, I have to make decisions too fast in multiplayer, but in a single player game, I should be doing more of that. I could probably play a higher level single player if I was doing that, even just with capital. Me and my game, I did it a little more normal-ish and wasn't leveraging them enough. And he met Pericles early. I didn't know Pericles was in there until much later. So I had actually dominated everybody else, but I could not make headway against Greece. So I had to go punch him in the face.
Yeah, Greece is the chief cultural enemy in this game.
Yeah, in my run through, I met Pericles first, which helped out a lot.
Yeah, that way you're warned in advance to just culture focus now.
I mean, when it's a culture win, I already knew I was going to need to build up a whole lot of culture, and yeah, just spam some religion, get a lot of value that way out of Khmer.
I used the standard ally Gilgamesh, so nobody will bother me tactic.
Ah, Gilgabro.
Yep. He was not next to me, so he was not hungry for my land. In my experience, I just did... Well, first of all, I started in the corner of a continent with the Cree right next to me, and then, like, this huge area of open land where one of us should have had our capital instead of both of us being on this smaller spot. So I just did the settler rush and sent out 8 settlers to that area and trapped Cree with one city in the area that I could fit myself. And this area also tended to have a lot of floodplained rivers. Like, there were 6 rivers that were all right next to each other and kind of connected that all had their own floodplains. So I didn't have any trouble growing really big cities, which I think is the key for this particular challenge. So I think having more cities made it easier for me to pump out the culture and tourism needed to eventually crest the victory, which did take over 350 turns because, well, I don't like to fight, but...
Yeah, but I also had the Kree close by. It almost felt like a Terra map where I was on the Terra piece of it. I had the Kree to north of me and had the Netherlands way south in the tundra of me. But the Kree forward settled me really early and I was like, are you serious? But I ended up finding the Netherlands first because she just... I forgot why I went against Netherlands first. She didn't do it quite as drastic. She did settle closer, but not, you know, ridiculous. Whereas Cree, it was like, I was too, like you, I was too close, our capital is too close to the Cree. And that was already going to be a problem in terms of religion or cultural pressure. So it's like, let me just get them and get this. And then, oh, I have all of this and I can pump out 10,000 tons of culture.
I think I had...
And still I needed to punch Greece in the face.
I think I had a faith output of something like 600 per turn by the end of the game.
Oh, I forget my exact numbers. I'd have to load the save. But it was ridiculous at the end. It was like, I almost could not spend it fast enough.
Oh, I just let the faith accumulate and then buy great people. When.
Yeah, great people. When I was finishing out settling my continent, but I was still was making a lot. It wasn't quite ludicrous yet, but hey, monumentality. Let me just spam settle the rest of the continent.
Why not? It's in the step, or it's in the step-by-step plan of taking over the world by culture. Empty yeah. land, you settle.
Pretty much. Yeah, I feel like monumentality is not coming back in Civ 7.
It is slightly hopey.
Because that thing is completely insane. Oh, Mackie, speaking of Potato McWhiskey, one of the things I really like is he has a workshop with a bunch of recommended UI mods. And that's part of the reason why he's able to do so well. Because he's a good player, and having a lot of those mods to help out with like the pins that show all the yields helps out with planning a lot.
That's something I would like. I mean, I'm getting ahead of it, but something for Civ 7, if the UI mods could be used in multiplayer. Because I could probably also do better in multiplayer if I could use those, but I get used to doing them in single player like in this game. And then I go over to multiplayer and it's like, oh, right, I can't plan all that out. And it doesn't show the yields. I mean, even in the base game, show me the yield when I plug down a district pin or something.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
I feel like.
Because they have all the pins to do that sort of stuff. And, you know, just having the yields would make it so much easier to work around.
Surely at this point you could convince Dan and the others to allow that. Then again, maybe not.
Well, it's a lot easier to leave it vanilla for everybody to connect, just in case the versions of mods get out of sync or what have you.
Yeah.
I think Steam is supposed to prevent that, but I guess knowing how EU4 and Vicky3 and CK3 and all those mods tend to frequently go out of date and also break all the time, who knows, but...
The mods might, but to be fair, we have not had too many issues playing total conversion mods in both Hearts of Iron 4 and EU4.
That's
true. When it comes to multiplayer.
Yeah, in their case, it might just be user error.
It's hard to say. Yeah, having the Steam Workshop set it up does make it easier, because unlike you could just say between each other, okay, I'm running exactly these mods, and then, well, you also get to check some in the Paradox games to reference. And then you could make up some random crap to troll your friends. Not that I would ever admit to doing.
No, never.
I will never admit it.
But especially on the UI side, if Firaxis could go and start to internalize some of the third-party mods, that would be nice. Like the pins one that we've been talking about, I would love to see that mainline.
Well, they did internalize one pin.
Yep, I want to see them do more of that overall.
I do too.
I just want to see UI improvements generally.
It's straight-up improvements. Like, here's this thing. It doesn't give away any information that's not already there. It just makes it easier to see. All right, we're adding that to the base game. Go.
Yeah, like the other one I have that's easy, as more, to me at least, better clarity in the reports. I can find things a lot easier. And then the quick deals thing. So, because that was, because Potato McWhiskey did those. There's this thing where the AI values diplomatic stuff really low, so you can like stock up on the diplomatic point favors. And then sell them later when somebody really values it. He did this with Pericles, where he was getting like, he was buying it for one gold a piece and then sale it to him for like 30 or something ridiculous, and got a chunk of change out of that.
Yeah.
But you have to manually go through and do all these trades one by one. You can't do it as a stack 10. You have to one individually one by one. With the quick mod, that was a lot easier. You could not make me do that in the regular vanilla Civ game, because oh my God, all the clicking through the Diplo screens.
And the more things change, the more they stay the same with some of that. That was totally a thing in Civ 4 as well.
But the screen in there that shows all the available deals, I love that. Because then I can go in there and look instead of having to click through every single AI and ask what they want. Ugh.
Yeah. Or you connect like a second copy and it's like, okay, now there's 8 other leaders I need to go talk to. Hold on.
Uh-huh.
Click.
I would do more trading with the AI when it's simpler like that.
What we need is a Secretary of State.
Mm.
That you can actually trust, yes?
Yes, obviously. There's no point in adding it to the game if it doesn't make it, if it's not trustworthy.
Well, I mean, that's an important caveat for sure, because it's going to be hard to make it good.
Well,
just go into hard mode, right? Have your Secretary of State go and list, like, half the deals.
If it just put the information in a more readable way. You could call that the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
Or not even the secretary, just make it the State Department.
I mean, anything to go and save on the amount of clicks.
Jonah Falcon in the chat, who is a previous Turncast guest co-host, says he's looking forward to new bells and whistles, personally.
That's true. They're going to have changed some things completely, and there'll be new things, and I am interested to see what's going to be completely new to us.
Yeah, we'll definitely get some new bells and whistles, and yeah, I'm curious. I'll be too.
And systems that we're used to from the previous games are probably going to work a little bit differently.
Yeah, I mean, I'm mostly curious as to what won't return and what's going to go and make a refresh return in a DLC or expansion.
Mm.
I hope loyalty doesn't return.
Really?
Yeah, I want it to be like it was in Civ 4 again.
Oh, with the culture borders? I mean, it's pretty similar conceptually to loyalty, though.
Yeah, but it's not... In Civ 4, it's not like an explicit thing that is uncounterable.
I mean, I wouldn't call it uncounterable in Civ 6 either.
But you get into a city that's on your border and it's already like at less than 5 turns to revolt. Like, this city's been next to your border for how long? Come on, there has to be some of your culture in there.
Yeah, the thing that always killed me about loyalty is if you ever went to war and you weren't right next to them already and had a lot of people next to them, you're like, oh, I took a city and now it just flipped.
Yeah, I would like some longer grace. That because like the de facto way to handle those situations is to just take a couple cities near the same time within 3 turns of each other, because then they all pressure each other.
You're talking 3 or more, though.
It's usually 3. A triangle of relatively large cities will suffice.
Yeah,
unless you're like sandwiched with one of them from like another civ also pressuring. But presumably if you're staging like an intercontinental invasion or something, you're picking your landing point. Avoid that.
Yeah, and what usually ends up killing me is when they have a bunch of mountains in the terrain or like a huge section of jungle with hills and stuff, and trying to get anywhere is a slog.
Yeah, that is extremely annoying before late game. Once it's late game, you can often play around that pretty easily, but before then it's miserable. Because once you have indirect fire or bombing or nukes or like ships that are good enough to just flatline a couple cities on the coast on the spot, then like terrain still matters, but it matters so much less. Plus, by that point, the roads and your policy cards are enough that you actually have some movement, too. So it becomes so much easier to play around stuff like that. But yeah, you're right. Miserable, like medieval times, if you're trying to fight in that terrain.
Yeah, and that's what happened in our last Turncast game. I was the only guy to conquer a city because of the fact that everyone had awful terrain and no one was close to each other, or to an AI. It was just like,
more
okay,
entertaining
yeah.
to pick like horrible Highlands maps and then go sparse resources.
No.
And then crowd it.
No.
This is the best game.
Denied.
You could disagree with me.
I do disagree with
you.
You
would be wrong.
I'm not wrong. Jonah Falcon says, the impossible feature that everyone wants. Great diplomacy.
It really is impossible because you can't make a great AI, pretty much, which we touched on earlier.
Yeah, I actually liked Civ 6's diplomacy. Like, it could definitely be better, but yeah, the whole voting gets you closer to a win and you get a lot of bonuses to voting. That helped a lot.
Yeah.
Yonder.
I think they did the best what they could with what they had in terms of the AI interactions. The problem is, like, we've touched on it so many times, the aligning AI's behavior towards winning the game versus role-playing is already a trade-off that the devs are having to make. Like, how much do you want to make the AI play the game versus pretend it isn't? And even with that aside, like, what the AI wants isn't coherent in many cases. So, like, you are going into designing your diplomacy with that as a constraint. It's almost impossible to then make the diplomacy good because the AI's long-range planning isn't good. So, like, it's not going to make anything sensible in trades or long-range planning arrangements that it could do with the player. Like, even if you make diplomacy perfect, if your AIs are like that, it just can't be. It'll be perfect for the AIs involved, but it won't feel good.
There's a way to do it. We just have not yet seen it done well.
I think you would have to address the conflicting incentives first before you could really make quote-unquote good diplomacy or great diplomacy.
Maybe you would have to change the priorities with which certain AIs make their decisions. I mean, theoretically, it's doable. You just have... I think it's a lot of trial and error that is just not cost-effective.
I think some people would still disagree on whether or not it's good diplomacy, because some people would expect the AI to act in its interests consistently when it comes to diplomacy. But it can't right now. Because it's been explicitly designed to not optimize winning the game.
Yeah.
These things butt heads with each other. You can't have the AI both roleplay and be effective in diplomacy consistently. Unfortunately. Because the game's roleplay does not align to winning. It does a little bit, but in a lot of ways it doesn't. So you're always going to get suboptimal outcomes somewhere as a consequence.
I think it's possible, but I can't do it.
You'd have to implement mechanics that are designed in a way that they actually are aligned. And that's tough. Maybe Civ 7 will do better than 5 and 6 and 4. Is the assigners aren't that aligned in 4 either.
Yeah, and it's definitely kind of tough to go and do that on the AI front. I'm just thinking about, what would you make an AI look like if you just tweak the AI based on difficulty? And then at AI 1, you have it making, I don't say random decisions, but like the worst possible decision. Having all of your settlers and workers run over and start attacking the enemy capital or whatever.
That sounds like a changing AI decision stuff based on difficulty.
Yeah, it would be kind of cool to do, but it's also just very difficult to do and very difficult to balance around. I'm not sure players would actually like it.
You don't need to program the AI to do dumb behavior. It will do it on its own.
Well, plus, is it within the developer's abilities to have the AI make optimal decisions for high-level play?
Yeah, that's one advantage that the human player has, is we can think longer term about what we're doing, whereas the AI, there's not enough room in its brain for that. It can maybe, at the most, is it what, one or two turns ahead or something like that?
Oh, it has different types of AI that go different lengths into the future.
Yeah, running concurrently. It's not like a coherent single AI making all the decisions.
Yeah,
which is what a human is.
Yeah, but like for the devs to make like a top end AI, this is kind of unrealistic anyway. But I don't like the being good at making a game is not the same thing as being good at playing. And devs are very frequently surprised by player performance. So like you'd have to have somebody on the dev team that's good at programming and can also play at high level in like multiplayer if you really wanted to start like making AI difficulty levels. Where rather than bonuses, it's just playing better. I don't think most of the devs can play as well as like the top players.
It's also just a resource concern, right? Let's say that you manage to find one of the best multiplayer Civ players ever. You hire him for your AI team, and he's also good at, or she is also good at doing AI programming. You're just like, okay, so we have a lot of talent in this one person. And you're up against, the internet with, someone who's probably not as good, but when you have, a million people, 2 million people, that's a lot of people who are, trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, the meta strategies will leave them behind very quickly. Absolutely. So you have to, constantly update AI. Because, even that player would then improve, but the AI wouldn't unless you explicitly go in and change it again. And then again, the next patch. And then again, a month later, when somebody finds out that actually what the community thought was optimal wasn't. It would never end. It's unless stopped updating the game.
It's like with the speedrunning community. Every time they think they've gotten to somebody and you can't shave more time off of it, somebody out in the community, sometimes an entirely new person, finds a new way. And it keeps going and keeps going until it's just absolutely ludicrous. And can you update an AI that fast? Nope.
Just ask ChatGPT to play the game. What could possibly go wrong?
Everything.
Tesla Cybertruck for $1. I want my dollar back.
Your dollar's already rusted away.
Oh, but how do you know that? I live in an area with weather.
Maybe one day they will at least get GPT to the point where it can consistently tell you legal moves. Not even playing well yet. Just it actually says to do things that are impossible. Today is not that day, and tomorrow probably won't be either.
Getting closer though.
Yeah, bit by bit. The improvement in functionality is incredible. I'm sure it will be quite impressive within 10 years. I don't know about in the domain of playing games, though.
It's a different set of AI. ChatGPT runs off of LLMs, and AI usually runs off of some form of search.
Yeah, although we're starting to see some evidence of LLMs picking up on capabilities. If you start sending it, I saw an experiment where someone was sending it screenshots and it realized that it could manipulate what the person puts in because the person kept pasting new screenshots. And with some percentage of the time, it would figure out, I can accomplish what they're asking me by telling them specific things. So they can have some ability to do that based on the prediction of the tokens. Now, it's a long way from that to playing a game. A long, long. I don't know that you could. I'm not sure it's possible. Maybe.
And usually the biggest thing is just how efficient the search is, right? You know, think about how many different moves that you have available to it, even at the start. And that's just a lot of area for it to try and search through. So even if you have very pruned trees with A star or whatever.
And you could prune Civ a lot. There are so many possible actions that are just obviously nonsense. But how do you set that algorithmically?
Yeah.
We're talking about deep level AI stuff now.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think that's
It's fun stuff to think about. It's not like I'm actually expecting ChatGPT to play Civ 7 at a high level in 5 years or something.
Maybe 100.
No, I don't. But it is fun to think.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what they do with the UI. So, looking forward to having the stream in August.
Me too. UI has been a gripe of mine for over a decade now, so hopefully. But I'm not going to get my hopes massively. We'll just go.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that everyone seems to love changing up the UI because it's relatively easy to do, and there's a lot of bad UI rewrites everywhere.
Yep. Yeah, but you occasionally get good ones.
It's also just less of a problem in some other game genres because, like, you're more dependent on a good UI in turn-based or RTS than you are in, like, it's easier to do a good shooter UI than a good good Paradox UI or good Civ UI.
Yeah, I mean, Doom has a very not good UI, but it works and people play it and the game is good.
Yeah. Oh, you could say the same thing about Civ.
Yeah.
Like, its UI is not good at all, but people enjoy it and it mostly gets the job done, even suboptimally. It gets the job done enough that people, like, actually still play the game, but it's not, like, good.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I feel like that's what ends up doing is, you know, it gets too good enough and they're like, okay, good enough, ship it. We need to make our quarterly revenue.
And it's hard to, like, it's hard to quantify how much value a better UI gives you. It's probably non-linear because good enough is a huge breakpoint, and then like improvements probably make more people play than otherwise, but you don't know exactly how many more.
Yeah, and that's always the toughest part. Whatever you have a metric for gets optimized for.
Sure, that is guesswork.
We should probably close up the show, though, because we've exhausted our Civ 7 topics.
For now, anyway.
Yeah.
Until August, when they show us things.
This has been Polycast episode 435, and I am Canis Alvinus. I've been joined with Makalua.
The hype train is at the platform, now boarding.
Me and team.
Technically, encampments are the best culture.
And New Earth Relic.
I always build Monument First, because I like a challenge.
I didn't even know that Monument First was considered a bad move.
It's okay. The biggest thing is Scout is just so much better on average because of Goody Huts.
Yeah, I usually build a Scout first, but...
Unless you turn them off. You only need Lucky Huts.
Lucky Huts. It's been a while but since I've been Lucky Huts.
Then you get a... Yeah, then you have to evaluate between, like, granary.
Just increase your luck skill.
Yeah, put more points into the luck
skill. But yeah, players also use heuristics for Civ as well. Like the always build scout first thing.
Yeah. Well, like I said, that depends on game settings. Because if you don't have the chance at huts, then I think scout's a little more dubious. It's like an obvious choice when your likelihood of getting at least something that is way more valuable than the time investment for the scout is close to guaranteed.
Yep. I think that's also part of the reason why Civ 5 continues to be fairly popular is because of the fact that as much as I like Civ 6's depth, having to go and plan out your city with all the districts and stuff is kind of a pain. It's just more work for the players.
No, a big part of that's due to the UI connecting with stuff.
It's a bit of both.
Yeah, but I mean, if you had all the information you needed at a glance, like as you had a settler selected or something, then it would be way less painful.
It's true.
combination of good UI and sufficient experience would probably kill most of the time that takes.
Yeah.
Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.